Let's go back and look right back where we were a moment ago. Three distinct areas, we said, but the trend has been an ever-increasing overlapping. And I mean overlapping, a breakdown in the distinction between the work, and thus a breakdown in the rules that govern the pattern God has given for how we're supposed to do one as opposed to the other. And I'm going to make that distinction as we go through it. Now, when we start talking about benevolence, I borrowed an old adage. In fact, this saying, I tried to find out who coined this phrase. And I thought I almost had it because someone in the early 1800s used this phrase, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, right? And I found that this person used it and popularized it, but it was an older, far older saying than that. And in fact, it got back to the point that nobody really knows where this saying came from. So this is an extremely old adage, an old point. The way to a man's heart is through his stomach, but it illustrates very well the attitude or the philosophy involved in benevolence in many churches and among many of our brethren. So the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. The line of reasoning is simple, and you can see how people look at it. And in fact, I think if we're all honest about it, we realize from a practical standpoint, I was saying to Gary a moment ago, I realize that if I do good, if I do a good deed for my neighbor, let's suppose, for example, that I've got a next-door neighbor, and I want to invite them to church, I want them to come, I want them to hear the gospel, I want them to be saved, obviously, and, you know, the next-door neighbor's wife gets sick, and, you know, Montel makes some extra dinner and carries it over there to them tonight because the wife is sick and she knows that that lady doesn't feel like preparing the meal. I know that's going to have an effect on them. I know that if they are people who are interested and looking anyway, that they're going to say, well, wow, that was a really good Christian thing to do. And that they might very well be more inclined to come to church and listen to the gospel. So I understand from a practical point of view that in our everyday lives, that's exactly the way things work. And, you know, I'm not trying to be insensitive to that whatsoever. I understand that. However, when we begin to reason like this for the Lord's church and the use of the Lord's treasury, we have to be very careful. Because listen how it would go. Souls can be more easily won by taking care of their physical needs first. It sounds right. It sounds like exactly the way I might approach my next door neighbor. But yet, everything is totally wrong with that statement. Souls can be more easily won. What's that focusing on? The philosophy of results. They can be more easily won by taking care of their physical needs first. What is that assumed? That God is telling the church to take care of the physical needs of our neighbors. You assume that, but we don't need to be assuming. We need to know what God's pattern is. If it's His pattern, fine. But if it's not His pattern, then there's everything wrong with the statement. Even though it sounds right, even though emotionally it seems to me like, well, that's exactly right. And even though I might compare it to what I do in my own life, there's still everything wrong with it. Now, here's what we would say. There's an umbrella, so to speak, of Galatians 6:10. And when I say umbrella, here's what I mean. Galatians 6:10 has just kind of been used as an all-encompassing passage. You might look at that passage, and it says, as we have therefore opportunity, let us do good unto all, or to all men, or unto everyone, depending on your translation. Now, that sounds like God is saying, any opportunity you have for doing any good for anybody, do it. In all circumstances, in all settings, and that's exactly the way some brethren have taken it. It's given license, as it were, or freedom, for a wide variety of works, as far as brethren are concerned, that's now come to be known generally as the social gospel. Now, that's just a term somebody coined. And I don't really use it a whole lot, except when I'm talking about the subject and preaching about it. But it just means all those things that people do to see to the physical needs of everybody else. And it is so prevalent among the denominations, as well as now, it is extremely prevalent among many of our own brethren. When we talk about benevolence, we're talking about, and it's defined as a disposition to do good, an act of kindness. Like I said, Montel goes next door to give some food to the neighbors. An act of kindness, a generous gift. You know, Juliet gives a lot of rides to people. We joke sometimes about being a taxi service. But, you know, just good things that you do for people. Generous gift, charitableness. These are works of benevolence. And so it's just a fancy term for doing a good thing for somebody. Now, in the New Testament, there are three different areas. Now we start looking at pattern, don't we? Because now we're not just talking about good things to do. Now we're talking about what the Bible says about benevolence, and God would divide it up into three distinct categories. One is what we do as an individual. My neighbor is sick. I help him out. The next one would be congregational. Now we're talking about something we do as the church. And there is also an additional thing that we may do, and this is where it gets difficult to maintain that distinction. Because God actually, in the area of benevolence, and notice what I'm about to say, in the area of benevolence only, God allows what might be called congregational cooperation. That's not my term. Somebody came up with it, so I'll use it. But it means, and I'll show exactly what it means, but it means where two churches may directly be involved, one contributing to the other. But now notice what I said. Only in benevolence. When we get to evangelism, we get to edification, that will not be the case. So God has a pattern, three different areas of benevolence. The individual, the church, and churches. One church to another church. Now that the individual is expected to use his ability, and I'm not going to spend time with these passages. I hope you know them. I'll mention a couple of them and go on. But that the individual Christian is supposed to use his ability to help other people in need, I think that's a given. I don't really think anybody calls that into question. Matthew chapter 6, Jesus spoke of doing your alms in secret. Don't let your right hand know what your left is doing. Oh, so many passages here. Acts 20 and verse 35, Paul quoted Jesus as saying, it is more blessed to give than to receive. We emphasized Ephesians 4:28 last night when we said, let him that stole steal no more. Rather, let him labor, working with his hands, that he may have to give to those who are in need. 1 Timothy chapter 5, you know, you're supposed to do good for your own family. Take care of members of your family. And on it would go. James 1 and verse 27, pure religion and undefiled before God the Father is this, that a man would keep himself unspotted from the world, but also that he would visit or relieve orphans and widows. And I'm paraphrasing a little bit there. But God certainly teaches us to do that. But the difference in philosophy, though, comes when we start asking the question, not what am I supposed to do as a Christian, but what is Piscataway supposed to do? What is the church as a whole, as a collective, supposed to do? The church has a collective responsibility, and you'll notice I put it in red. Jerry put it in red for me, but I put it in bold for Jerry because I want that to stand out. The church has a collective responsibility to relieve needy saints. Now, I'm going to make a statement to you. I didn't put it on here like this, but I'm going to make this statement, and I want you to understand this is exactly what I believe. If you look at every passage on here, if you look at any passage in the New Testament, every single one of them, without exception, if it involves spending the Lord's money in that passage, this is not one of those things where you have to, you know, where somebody says, oh, you go over here and you say one verse and you try to connect it back here and it doesn't connect. Every single passage emphasizes when the Lord's money is to be spent, it has to be for needy saints. Now, there's a list of passages. Acts chapter 2, when they were all gathered together in Jerusalem, and again in Acts chapter 4, people were selling their property, giving the money so that those who were basically there, you know, living for 3 years and didn't plan to be, could be helped, could be supported, food, shelter, and clothing. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, we see, yes, individuals being supported by, of course, you and I are supposed to take care of our parents and so forth. But we also see the fact that if an individual does not have children to help them when they get older, yes, the church can be involved. Acts chapter 11 we'll come back and talk to, but that's that church-to-church contribution. And in fact, 1 Corinthians chapter 16, we see the collection taken for the saints, and we see a number of passages, and you'll see I have them in parentheses, because in Acts 24, Paul took a contribution to Jerusalem for the poor saints at Jerusalem. And in 1 Corinthians 16, Romans 15, and 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, it shows us examples of all those churches, in fact, contributing that money. So we see the example of them contributing for that occasion, and that's why it's all in parentheses there. But let me go on and be specific about this. A person can see from these examples, especially these latter examples, that when a church does not have ability to relieve its own needy saints. Now, what am I saying there? Let me slow down for a moment and try to make this as clear as possible. Let's suppose that the church at Piscataway, and I don't know what it would be, but let's say some disaster hits Piscataway. Let's say a tornado comes through. And every member here is affected. Just devastated. Let's suppose we live in a place and time where if a tornado comes through and tears up your home and wrecks everything you have, that you are going to be destitute. You will not have a place to live. You won't have food to eat. You won't have clothes because the only clothes you got out with were the ones on your back, and that might have been pajamas. No one, the church doesn't have ability to take care of every one of its members because the whole church is affected. No one is going to be able to contribute, dig a little deeper into their pockets because now we're suddenly all destitute. What God provides for, and you'll notice the way I say it here, when a church does not have the ability to relieve its own needy saints, it has that responsibility, but God recognizes that there will be occasions due to whatever it might be, some storm or some famine or some natural disaster or whatever it might be, that could happen. And when that happens, Piscataway could appeal to other churches. Maybe they appeal to the church at East Orange. Maybe they appeal to churches in Virginia, whatever it might be. But they may appeal to other churches for help, and those churches can send money, send relief, to Piscataway. And in fact, if you look at Acts chapter 11 and verses 27 through 30, you'll see that exact example. In fact, the first night, if you remember, we were talking about elders and all of that. We mentioned Acts 11 because that's the first mention of elders. But if you look at exactly what's going on there, Agabus the prophet comes to Antioch in Syria and announces that there is going to be a famine. Okay? And that this famine is going to make the church in Jerusalem destitute, or Judea, destitute. And if you notice exactly what the passage is saying, it is saying that when that famine hits, all the saints, all the Christians, are going to be equally affected. They're not going to have food to eat. And so Agabus is appealing to the church at Antioch for help. And the Bible says that the church at Antioch sent money. In fact, Paul and Barnabas carry the money. They send money from Antioch to Judea to relieve the saints there. Now, that's exactly what we're talking about here. When a church, Judea, doesn't have the ability to relieve its own needy saints, it appeals to other churches. In this case, it appealed to Antioch for help. And that's called congregational cooperation. And that's exactly what the New Testament teaches. So the model would go something like this. And I don't know if this really makes a lot of sense. I hope it does. But you have a church, Judea, or rather Antioch. You have a church, Antioch, and it sends relief, and that's in this case money. I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me back up. Erase that. Okay. The way things should be, I had it right in the first place, the way things should be and normally will be, is Judea will be able to relieve its own needy saints. Now, what would be the difference? Let's suppose in Judea everything is fine. I mean, there's no famine and everybody is out working their crops and their farms and money, normal course of events. Everybody's prospering well. But let's say that the father of one family has an accident. He breaks his legs. He can't go out and work. He can't raise a crop that year. He can't provide for his family. He goes to the church in Judea, and Judea, everybody else is working, everything is fine, they have money in the treasury for exactly this kind of thing. The church in Judea gives money to its own needy saints. It gives money to that faithful individual with the broken legs, and they go on. Next year, he goes back to work, he works his crops, everything is fine. But if the famine comes, drop down to the next line. If the famine comes and everybody is destitute, then the church would appeal to Antioch, perhaps to other churches. In the case, you remember all those examples I mentioned a moment ago in the Acts 24 situation? In that case, they appealed to Rome, they appealed to the churches of Galatia, they appealed to the churches of Macedonia and Achaia. All those churches contributed money to the church at Jerusalem, who in turn took the money and relieved its own needy saints. Now, the reason I put it that way is because you have to understand that all that's really happening here in the area of benevolence is a church is relieving its own needy saints. But when it doesn't have the ability to relieve its own needy saints, that's not, understand I'm going to use a term here. The fact that we're all hungry is not a created need. We didn't sit down and just come up with this need that requires a whole lot of money. We have to eat. You look at somebody like me, I have to eat. You know, we have to eat. And so God makes a distinction here. Not a created need. We didn't go to all these other churches and say, we made up this thing, so now we've got $1 million debt, and we need you to help us out. We're going to these churches, and we're saying to these churches, if you don't help us out, our members die. They don't eat. They don't have shelter from the cold. They die. And God is making a distinction in the area of benevolence because it's not a created need. It is, in truth, a necessity. The word needy, the word that's translated needy so many times, means exactly that. It means to be destitute. It means dire circumstances. Food, shelter, and clothing are about as destitute as it gets. So a church helps its own, and if it can't, in that one case, it's able to go to another church and say, we can't, will you help us, and can you help us? And obviously churches do. Now notice this, when the treasury, again, we take money, we're going to collect money later today, I'm sure, and if you're a member here at Piscataway, you're going to put money in the basket or the plate or whatever comes around. When that money is taken, it goes into a treasury, and there are two primary qualifications for money to be spent back out of it. In every case, no matter what you're talking about, the work of the church, and these two primary qualifications in the area of benevolence are this, and it's very simple. If someone is going to get money from the church treasury, then this has to be the case. Number one, they've got to be saints. Just because someone is in need does not qualify money coming out of the treasury. Emotionally, I might think, boy, this is God's money, and God would want you to help this person out. That's not God's pattern. That's not what God has said. But you know, emotionally, think about it for a moment. If you'd been Uzzah, emotionally, that ox, I mean, forget the fact that, you know, we got it out here on an ox cart. That's not what's important right now, is it? This Ark of the Covenant is on this ox cart, this 500-year-old, one-of-a-kind Ark of the Covenant is on this ox cart. And now the oxen are stumbling, and this 500-year-old, one-of-a-kind, made by the hands of Moses' brother, Ark of the Covenant, is going to fall to the ground and bust. Would not God want me this one time to reach my hand out and keep this thing from falling? Now, that sounds right, doesn't it? That's the way we think. And God struck him dead. It's a violation of the pattern. It's a pattern that says stick sticks through rings on a box. Now when I think about it like that, and I come back to this, and I begin to hear things like, would not God want us to help this poor individual? No. From your pocket maybe, but not the treasury. No emotional argument will argue for doing things against God's pattern. And if I have to be reminded of that, I go back to these pages and I see these examples where God, in almost every case, when they didn't follow the pattern, He killed them. And it emphasizes the point, I mean for my pattern to be followed. They have to be saints. They have to be faithful members of the Lord's church. Not just, you know, an individual that one time was on the roll, but saints. Saints means someone who's set apart, someone who's holy, someone who's separate from the world. They have to be faithful members of the Lord's church. And secondly, they have to be needy. I'm told there was an occasion at East Orange. I'll tell that situation a little bit, but I'm told there was an occasion at East Orange way in the past, years ago, where an individual came to the church. He didn't tell them up front. He kind of cheated them. But he came as though he was needy, and really what he was needy was for a new truck, and so he got money so he could go buy a new truck. They found out about it, and fortunately they disciplined him for that. But having a new truck is not a need. It's a great want. I'm driving a car out there I wish I could replace right now. You know, it's a want. But we're not talking about that kind of thing. The word means to be destitute of basic needs. So they've got to be a saint, and they've got to be needy. Now, there's not a single command in Scripture, not a single command in which God allows us to take not a command, not an example, not an inference, not an inferred directive, where God allows us to take money out of the treasury for the relief of any who do not meet those two basic requirements. If they're not needy, they don't qualify for money from God's treasury. If they're not a saint, they don't qualify for money from God's treasury. Not a single command, example, or inference in the New Testament, in the Bible, for taking money out of the treasury for relief. And yet, here's the emotional appeal. The emotional appeal is to relieve the physical needs of the world. It's a good work. And brethren will answer that. Even you say all of that, you go through all the principles, yeah, but it's a good work. It'd be a good thing to do. And go back to those two basic philosophies, results over pattern. And it has the natural attraction of drawing people. If my neighbor is going to be more inclined to come visit with me because I give him supper tonight when his wife is sick, then what about bringing that on a full, big scale and feed everybody's neighbor's families whose wives are sick? And have all the people be attracted to come? Why not feed all the hungry or do all of those kinds of things? Because it has a natural attraction of drawing people to become new members, and that's not lost on its proponents. They understand that. And here's where the overlapping, you know, begins. Do a good thing, benevolence, and we attract people, evangelism. So we kind of overlap these two things. Thus, it becomes the justification because the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. So we've seen the explosion of the social gospel. Boy, that was a jump, wasn't it? Not so much. At one time in this country, churches, and I mean churches of Christ, churches simply digressed in the form of benevolent institutions. Go back 100 years and this is what you had. 1910, Nashville, Tennessee, Tennessee Orphan Home. You had orphans' homes. You had Arkansas, Bowles Home for the Aged. You had orphans' homes and homes for the aged. You had institutions. You had places, buildings, I mean literally. And money was contributed from churches, a church maybe, in the case, if it was big enough, like Nashville, or a bunch of churches, like all the churches of Cullman and beyond, Cullman, Alabama, contributed money and, what was that thing? Child Haven, right? Child Haven. Orphan home. Everybody contributed money and they built this orphan's home. And so congregations built and maintained these organizations to relieve the needy. Now there was no regard for their status as a saint. Obviously if you're dealing with orphans, generally speaking, you're talking about children who are not even old enough to obey the gospel. So no regard for their being a saint. They were just needy. And so churches digressed in the form of these institutions. They built these things. Now that was the past. The model would have gone something like this. a church, Nashville, or churches, all the churches of Coleman County, let's say, contributed money to the institution, Child Haven, Tennessee Orphan Home. And then that money was spent to relieve the needs, but notice, not needy saints, needy individuals. And that was pretty much the model. That was the past. Of course, someone reasoned like this. You know, individuals need a lot more than food, don't they? I mean, really, if I were to ask you to sit down and write out a list of your needs, I'd get off on that for a moment. I'd get really sidetracked, you know, for a moment. Go back 150 years, and if you ask people to make a list of their needs, they put about a half dozen things down there, and it'd be things like food, flour, you know, that kind of thing. When you ask people today to make a list of their needs, and they do this in schools sometimes, and they get kids to do this, and kids can come up with a list of 100 things they need. They need a new bicycle. They need a trip to Disney World. They need, I mean, you can't imagine what all they need. They need it, and they will tell you. And those of you that are parents in the audience, no doubt your kid has come to you and said, I need it. Well, brethren have reasoned the same way. Individuals need a whole lot more than just food, shelter, and clothing. And they need recreation. They need interaction with their peers. Kids need to play with other kids. Adults need to play with other adults. You know, we need interaction with our peers. Need better marriages. Who would deny that? I mean, we need our marriages just in general in this country to be better. Divorce rate is high, etc. People need that. And so forth, and so forth, and so forth. They need things. And so brethren said, well, that justifies the building and maintaining, not just of an orphan's home, or a home for the aged, a retirement home, or whatever you want to call it, but it justifies building a kitchen and a fellowship hall. Because we don't just need the food. We don't want to just give them the money to go out and buy a can of beans. They need the interaction. They need the support of their brethren. So we'll build a kitchen and a fellowship hall. They need recreation, so let's have a sports team. We'll have a softball team. And so we'll go out and buy a bunch of bats and balls, and we'll put a field out back and all of that kind of thing. A lot of money is spent for that. They need recreation facilities. You know, they need a place to come in and play basketball or ping pong or whatever it might be. We need to get them off the streets is the idea. They need medical facilities. You don't just need food, shelter, and clothing. Sometimes you get sick and you get a broken leg. And you need help. And so we have all these hospitals and so forth that have gone up. They need retreat facilities. Because if anybody needs to retreat from this world, you know, if people in this society right now get away for a weekend, I mean, it'll do people a world of good. The young people, send them to camp. Wouldn't that be a great thing? Get them off the streets and get them to a camp with other good young people so they can grow and be built up and come to know Jesus and all of that kind of thing. That's a good thing. It's a need. And man, you can go on and on with that ad nauseum. People have needs, they will tell you. So now we see multifaceted efforts to relieve the world's needy. And what happens, I mean, go back to that list. What kind of money do those things cost? I know Gardner Hall runs a camp, and I've talked to Gardner about the amount of money that's spent each year, and it's a little mind-boggling. When you start talking about a retreat, I mean, you start talking about a nice facility for a bunch of couples to go away to for a weekend. You know how much something like that cost? Just putting a sports team, a soccer team, or a softball team together, you know how much that cost? Man, imagine what it costs to build a hospital. When we start talking about that kind of thing, we know that no church, Piscataway doesn't have that kind of money. And not many churches do. Remember the statistics from Friday night? The majority of churches are well under 100 people. Nobody has that kind of money. But if we all pooled our money together, we could build that retreat. And we can use it 1 week, and Church of East Orange can use it the next week, and so forth and so on. 52 churches pool their money, you can build a nice retreat. 52 churches use it 1 week a year for now till whenever. That sounds like a good deal. And that's exactly the kind of thing you're getting. So disaster relief programs. Katrina hits in New Orleans. We need to help those people out. I can't do it. You can't do it. The Church of Piscataway can't do it. But we can join in with East Orange and all the churches of Louisiana, and we can do it. And so that's what you're getting. And after all, remember, it makes a great impression, and people are far more inclined. They saw the Church of Christ there, and they'll be more inclined to go through the doors of a Church of Christ. So it comes by way of the sponsoring church arrangement, and what happens is this. A congregation takes on a benevolent program. It far exceeds its ability. It appeals to one or more congregations to provide the additional needed funds to accomplish it. For example, we're going to relieve all the flood victims of Katrina. We're going to feed all the hungry in South America. I don't know what kind of astronomical figure that would be. But some church at Piscataway, takes on the work, going to feed all the hungry people in South America. How many churches do you think you're going to have to go to, and how much money are you going to have to raise? Now, notice the difference between that and Jerusalem. What is the difference? Jerusalem's members, by famine, had a need that they didn't create. If you want to say, it was an act of God. If anybody created it, God created it. But not the members at Jerusalem. So God allows that church at Jerusalem, when the famine comes, to go to the church at Antioch and say, we can't feed our members. Can you help us? God allows that. But that's not the church at Piscataway saying, we have had a flood, and none of our members are going to be able to eat if you don't help us. The difference is, the church at Piscataway is saying, New Orleans had a flood. Not just the church, but all the people in New Orleans suffered, and we at Piscataway are going to take the responsibility to feed all the hungry people in New Orleans. And we can't do that without your help. It's a creative need. It is not something that God put on Piscataway. You put it on Piscataway. You put the responsibility on Piscataway, and now you are going out to other churches and saying, because we created this need, you help us. And that's not what God has told us to do. We don't have a command for that. We don't have an example of a church doing that, and we certainly cannot draw that as a necessary conclusion. The model would be like that. Churches sending the money to that sponsoring church. Piscataway is going to sponsor the relief of all the flood victims. And obviously relief is given to needy individuals. So what's really going on? Well, fundamentally, we dig all through the emotion, and here's what we get. There's a disregard for God's pattern. That's what's really going on. God had a pattern for the way of doing things, but we're doing something different. We're going beyond, like that 2 John 9, we're walking around the table. We're going beyond the table and doing something else. Even a complete denial, and we'll get more into that, that there is such a thing as a pattern. The basic justification, when there ever is one, and Jerry, I noticed last night, I left the passage out of here. But the basic justification for it, if there ever is one anymore, is to go to Galatians 6 or James 1, passages that tell the individual, remember we started with that, tell you and me to do good when I have an opportunity to do it. Going from that to somehow reason that we may create a need and solicit other churches to help us relieve, in this case, of this created need. But really, there's not even a justification for it anymore. The justification is just emotional. Forget the passages anymore. Rarely does anybody go to them or try to argue them. The justification is emotional. It's a good work, they will say. Who in the world would deny that feeding hungry people is a good thing to do? And that's exactly the way they'll put it to you. How do you think God would not want you to help these hungry people? And when you say, no, I don't think God would want us in that way to help these hungry people, people look at you and say, man, you know, what kind of cold-hearted legalism is that? It's a demand for a pattern. It's us touching the ark. It's me saying I've got to do it the way God said do it, or else. Because He's God, and I'm not. And that's the idea. It has the added benefit of attracting larger numbers. I'll give you that. If Piscataway would start doing that kind of thing, I don't know what you might come up with in this area that would be conceived as a pressing need in this locale. But if you came up with something like that and you could get enough people to help you do it, you would get bigger numbers. I don't have any doubt about that. It works. It works almost 100% of the time everywhere that anybody tries it. But what do you get them to? Are we trying to build an ark to save people from the flood? Are we just trying to have a big crowd? And which thing are we trying to accomplish? You can get the bigger numbers. Noah might have built a more attractive boat. He might have built a luxury liner. And he might have gotten more than 8 people on it. But would it have sunk when the flood came? Because he didn't do it like God commanded him to do it. Now that's the question. I might get the larger crowds, but will they be saved in the end if we disobey and rebel against God's pattern? We dare not. God forbid it, the Jews said in Joshua. The way to a man's heart is through his stomach. Souls can be more easily won by taking care of their physical needs first. That's the argument. But the problem is, it doesn't accomplish the good that we needed to accomplish. Now I'm going to let Jerry put this next one up, and I'm going to get my... And I've got a couple more minutes. I'm going to introduce the second part of this. I promise you I'm going to finish on time. I'm working it out in my head as we go. Ready? All right, great. All right, so now we start lesson two. But really, as I said, it's one continuous lesson. Because we go from benevolence. We've laid all the groundwork, so we don't have to do that in the second part. But we go from benevolence, we go directly from benevolence to the whole idea of evangelism. We've been talking about, haven't we? We finished benevolence by talking about that, but that's exactly where we are. We're discussing the work in the light of these two prevailing philosophies. Do we emphasize the pattern? Do we emphasize the results? Remember that the disregard for the pattern given by God is what I consider to be the most troubling trend in the Lord's church. Because it affects everything. We emphasize those two patterns of Noah building the ark and what the Jews said. God forbid that we rebel against God's pattern. What is the work of the church? The collective work, taking money out of the treasury, you'll contribute here very shortly. When you take money out of the treasury, God has commands, examples, conclusions that we draw, inferred directives for taking that money and putting it toward evangelism. We're about to talk about that. Obviously, the benevolence. And finally, we will talk about edification. Now, let's do a basic overview and say it again. When we talk about the work of the church, these three areas, they are separate and distinct. We must maintain that they are separate and distinct works. But the trend has been to overlap. One leads to a way to a man's heart is through his stomach. You want to evangelize him? Do a good deed for him first. Overlapping. And what that really is a disregard for the Lord's pattern. That's most definitely clear when we talk about evangelism. Obviously, because I just spent the lesson on benevolence, half of it talking about evangelism. And the reason I do that is because that's where the mindset of people is. But we're going to go further with that as we talk about evangelism. And let's just stop with this point. This would be a great place to stop. The one group, again, like you and me, we're going to say, okay, if we're going to evangelize, if we're going to teach people the gospel, let's go to the Bible and see what the Bible says. Tells me how to teach them, tells me what to teach, doesn't it? That's the pattern. So they're going to try to find the pattern in the Word of God for reaching the lost with the gospel. But the majority of people are going to say, let's reach the largest number of people so we may present them the gospel. In other words, they're going to ask a simple question, what works best? And I want you to think about that question over the next few minutes before I come back up here. Because if you ask it like that, what works best? Man, what answer could you give? What works best? Let's leave it at that and we'll come back. Thank you very much for your attention. And we'll pick up and hopefully have a very interesting lesson to follow.